Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. 1 year ago, California legalized marijuana. At the time, proponents argued that legalization would bring thousands of new jobs and millions of new tax dollars into state and local governments. People were predicting a green gold rush. So is the cannabis industry booming or is it a bust? What are the challenges of doing business in an industry that had a thriving black market but is now highly regulated? How do you pay your taxes when you're not allowed to use a bank? And are the communities most affected by the criminalization of marijuana being left behind? These are just some of the questions we'll be addressing tonight with my guests. In studio, we have Lindsay Robinson, the executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. Prior to becoming the executive director of that organization, Lindsay was with the Marijuana Policy Project, which was responsible for passing adult use initiatives in Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maine. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you.
We also have Alfonso Blunt Jr. and Brittany Moore, principals of Blunt and Moore, a dispensary in Oakland, California. Alfonso is one of the first recipients of a cannabis equity permit from the city of Oakland. He's a lifetime Oakland resident and has worked for Alameda County for 13 years. Welcome, Alfonso.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. And his business partner, Brittany Moore, is also with us. She has several years of operational experience as the general manager of cannabis dispensaries in Colorado and California. She's a member of a number of organizations focused on participation and economic empowerment for cannabis businesses, including the Hood Incubator, the Minority Cannabis Business Association, and Women Grow. Welcome, Brittany.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to have you. Finally on the phone, we have Eugene Hilsman. He's the acting director of San Francisco's Office of Cannabis. He previously served as the deputy director of the office, and prior to that, he completed his doctoral work at Princeton University, where his dissertation examined American marijuana policy and looked at the impact of the war on drug on disadvantaged communities. Welcome, Eugene.
Happy to be with you.
Thank you. We hope you will join us for the conversation when we open the phone lines in 20 minutes. Call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Also, send us a tweet at cityvisionskalw. How has legalization impacted your life? Are you part of this industry? And do you think it needs more or less regulation? So with that, I thought we'd just dive in to talk to those of you who are on the front lines, Alfonso and Brittany. Tell us how business is going at your dispensary. Brittany?
It's going really well. We opened in a very difficult time. We opened in the middle of holidays, and so it was an interesting battle to get some of the people to come into the stores instead of, you know, traveling and buying turkeys. But it's actually going much better. We are seeing an increase in participation and in revenue each week. And so we're excited about that, definitely. We obviously face challenges every day, like any business that's starting up. But so far, so good. I think we're on the right path.
And Alfonso, how did you get into this business?
Currently?
Yes.
Got a phone call about a year and a half ago or so to meet with this young lady, and that was it. And it's been kind of like history in the making since then.
Well, you are one of the first recipients of an equity permit. Can you tell us what that is?
So Oakland had a program established in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To give a chance for people who had been dealing with the war on drugs negatively, a chance to effectively be owners, growers, whatever, different licenses legally. And I didn't know anything about this. Found out through her, and here I am, the first winner of it.
And how had the war on drugs impacted you personally?
Me personally, everybody in my family has been to jail for some form of drugs, whether it be weed, crack, heroin, whatever. Friends, family, associates. So I use that for me in my black market dealings to move a little bit differently because I didn't want to go to jail. But I've just seen it, like, affect everybody, rip families apart for a dime bag of weed. You know what I mean? So it's negatively affected my family and extended family. So this feels good to be able to do something positive with it.
So you went from being a dealer prior to legalization mm-hmm. to now having your own legal business.
Yes, ma'am.
And your name is particularly good, I think, for your business. Your last name's Blunt. Brittany, your last name's Moore. So your dispensary is Blunts and Moore.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
Was that hard to come up with that name?
It was.
Initially, yes, it was. We was going back and forth about a bunch of different names, and it just finally clicked like, use our last names. And here we are.
Well, that's great. Lindsay, can you give us an overview of of how the industry has been working in this last year, I think people thought that revenue was going to be up and taxes were going to be up, but I think there was a bit of a shortfall, wasn't there?
Yeah, definitely. It has been a pretty difficult year for those operating on the legal side of the market, for sure. You know, there are a ton of hurdles, which I'm sure we'll get into, and barriers to entry. And so we've really seen a lot of companies struggle, even the large companies. You know, they were expecting kind of a flood of folks in, you know, last January right after legalization. And there was all this excitement. And then there was real sticker shock when folks got into a retail operation and saw that cannabis was 30, 40, 45% higher than it was, that it had just been even on the legal side for, you know, in the month before, and certainly higher than on the illicit side. So That has been difficult, I think, for a lot of folks who want to buy on the legal side. They want to make sure they have, you know, regulated and tested cannabis, and that, you know, they're contributing tax revenue. But we've seen a slower upstart than I think a lot of lawmakers anticipated. I think a lot of folks in the industry mm-hmm. knew that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And in fact, CCIA talked with lawmakers quite a bit about how high the taxes were, and we continue to have those conversations.
Well, can you break it down for us? Why is it so expensive to buy legal marijuana, Lindsay?
Yeah, well, it is taxed at basically every step through the supply chain. So there's cultivation tax. There are, you know, excise tax at both local and state. It's just compounding every time, really, that cannabis moves, it gets taxed. So, you know, again, it's upwards of 30, 40, 45% above what it was. And obviously, we know that we need taxes, right? We need to generate taxes to go back into the community, to do education, you know, to help with research. On you know, the possibilities of this incredible plant, but we need it to be a sensible structure so that people have incentive to buy on the legal side.
And Alfonso and Brittany, are you finding that with your clients that the cost of cannabis is too much and keeping them out of your dispensary?
Definitely. And so before owning this dispensary, I was a general manager at another one, and it was prior to legalization, and we were medicinal, obviously. And we were actually doing much better than we were after we went into regulation. Instead of doubling our demographic, we kind of traded out because the medicinal users were used to 9% and change and not, you know, 29% and change, whereas the recreational users were so new to it all that the sticker shock wasn't as great for them. And so instead of kind of being able to bring both parties in, the medicinal side kind of literally sat in our face and told us we're going to the black market because we can't afford it anymore. And so unfortunately that hurts business, you know, from a retail perspective as well as cultivation and everything else. It kind of makes the market a little unfair for us right now.
And Alfonso, I know sometimes you go by Tucky.
Yes, ma'am.
So Tucky, how are you guys combating that?
Just trying to come a little bit under everybody else's prices, but not too much so that, you know, we're going to be in the hole forever. But we just try to have and kind of like accommodate to where we are location-wise and the demographic of where we're at, and just try to have prices based on that. But still, it's a lot. I mean, just have to be honest, it's a lot. It's a lot of taxing going on in cannabis right now. So.
But Eugene Hilsman, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about the fee structure in San Francisco and how that's affecting businesses?
I believe there's not a local specific excise tax for cannabis, right? So there's the general sales tax, but there's not an additional tax for cannabis-related product. Proposition D, which was passed by the voters in the fall of 2018, levies a gross receipt tax on recreational cannabis businesses of between 1% and 5%, but that tax won't start until January 1st, 2021.
So is it cheaper to buy marijuana in San Francisco than in other places in the Bay Area because of the lack of the tax?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you would have to ask the consumers that, for sure.
And what is it like to start a business in San Francisco if you wanted to start, for example, a dispensary? How does one go about that?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that's required in the city of San Francisco is that you need the authority to be able to apply for a cannabis permit. Right now, the cannabis permitting process is only open to equity applicants. These are individuals who've been negatively and disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs and existing industry. For example, existing medical cannabis dispensaries that were in operation before legalization and other parts of the supply chain, right? So new businesses must come in through the equity program. Either you meet the criteria, which I can go into if people are interested, or you commit to supporting the business development of someone that does through a process we call incubation.
And since legalization, how many new dispensaries do we have in San Francisco?
Yeah, so currently we haven't permitted any new businesses, right? So they're in various stages of the pipeline, but we have about 34 existing medical cannabis dispensaries in the city.
And the ones that were those existing medical marijuana dispensaries?
That's correct.
And when do you expect more dispensaries to open?
So hopefully sometime this year.
And how many do you think that we'll be getting in San Francisco?
Well, unclear, right? So we have a number of applicants in our system. One of the things that I think we anticipated or did not necessarily anticipate was a significant demand for cannabis business permits. So right now we have about, thinking about the number of storefront retail applications, all of them won't be viable, but we have a website where you can see where those proposed locations are in our system in about 70 to 80.
So San Francisco is possibly going to have 70 to 80 new dispensaries?
That's possible, right? So these are just applications at this point.
Tucky and Bree, I see you guys shaking your head. What's what's your concern?
For me, that's just a very large number of dispensaries for a space so small. It starts the race to the bottom, you know, when you're trying to compete with what makes you different, your pricing. And so as you start the race to the bottom, you kind of start to upset the cultivators who are giving you your product. And it'll be interesting to see that level of saturation. But I came from Denver, so it's much more saturated there than it could ever be probably in the Bay Area. So I'm sure there's ways to navigate through it. But it's just interesting that that many licenses that will be allowed, you know, for retail space.
And Tucky, how many are permits or dispensaries are there in Oakland?
The new program is 8 total. I don't know how many. Is it? Oh, it's 8. It's 8 original, if I'm not mistaken. So it's 16 total, if I'm not mistaken. 8 that just came about mm-hmm. with us, the 4 general, 4 equity, and then there was 8 already established. So 16 total.
And are you anticipating more dispensaries in the city or?
So right now, there are 9 of us that are open. We are the only ones that are online out of the 8 that were given this last year. Mm-hmm. And so the remaining 7, we're planning to come between the next 6 months to a year behind us.
Well, Bree, you mentioned Colorado, and mm-hmm. I think you worked in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
What are some lessons that we could learn from the experience that Colorado has? It's 5 years since they legalized.
It took them a couple of years to figure it out as well, as it will take California. I think that enforcement is a big deal. I think that it's cool to set up all of these regulations. We have to have someone to enforce them to compete with Measure Z's right now, which are clubs that aren't exactly legal and don't have to pay taxes. It's difficult to compete with sessions, which is where people are, literally having black market retail moments in your neighborhoods. It gets difficult because, we've got a lot to pay for on our end, and so the product ends up being a little more expensive. I think that Denver allowed us, if you will, to be the bakery and bake the bread. And so you could cultivate and take it straight to retail, where now in California you have to go through this distribution license, which creates another level of taxation, creates higher priced products. And so there are a couple of things I think that, as we mentioned earlier, over-regulation, I think, is definitely happening here. But as, those of us that are in the market start to complain a little bit more, hopefully they'll start to craft laws that fit what we need to be able to be successful.
Well, Tucky, what can you get in your dispensary that you can't get in the black market and vice versa?
Ooh, that's a good question. I honestly don't know because I'm no longer deal with the black market anymore, none whatsoever. But I know what I can speak on as far as experience from having to deal with the black market. You're going to get a happy environment, good prices, good people. And hopefully want to come back. But I just think we just have good product. And I haven't been on the black market in a while. So I can't even speak to what all they have. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think that testing is what you can get on the legal market that you can't get on the black market.
That's why
a product that you know is safe to consume. And I think that's the most important, definitely.
Go. Yeah. Well, Lindsay, turning back to you, and Bree mentioned maybe possibly overregulation of the industry. What's your take on it?
Yeah, it is a very challenging landscape for many reasons. The high taxes, which we already talked about, really high barriers to entry. Part of the difficulty, I think, that a lot of folks are having navigating the current legal landscape, is that we have a dual licensing system in California. So in order to get a state permit, you have to have a local permit, or a state licensed, you have to have a local permit. And we have roughly 2/3 of the state that has no local permits option right now. They don't have any ordinances on the books for commercial cannabis activity. So that's a de facto prohibition in those areas. So operators who might have been compliant, who want to be compliant, who are operating in those areas, have no pathway to do so. So there's a lot of local control in that dynamic, and that's certainly healthy, because communities need to decide where they want retail operators, what type of licensing they want to allow, whether they want manufacturing or distribution or retail. So that is a really important piece of it. But there has been kind of this lack of push for local ordinances to go through, and that's something that CCIA is working on. I know there's a lot of stakeholders in the state who are really trying to create some viable options for those communities to come online, so that folks can actually be licensed. Licensing fees are really high. Compliance overall is incredibly difficult. And, Brianna touched on a really important piece, which is enforcement and kind of the back and forth of how do we create a regulated system and have manageable, workable enforcement that really takes into consideration how difficult it is to survive on the regulated side.
Yeah. Now, Eugene, talking about regulation, San Francisco obviously has local ordinances. Do you think the city is kind of in the vanguard for California municipalities?
I mean, I think in a number of ways, right, San Francisco's taking a lead, particularly with thinking about things like compassion programs. So that's one of the reasons why you see such a robust existing industry for storefront dispensaries, for example, right, is because the city has long had a commitment to making sure people who needed access to safe and legal product had access to it.
Well, can you explain what a compassion program is?
Yeah, for sure. So in thinking about people who are looking for access to particular products, right? So before legalization, the supply chain, thinking specifically about kind of available cannabis, was only for people who were able to demonstrate that they needed it for medical purposes, right? So there was existing industry for people who could demonstrate that they needed access to it, and there was a robust market for those types of stores.
Right. And do you feel those people who are kind of in the medical dispensary world are getting equal access to becoming legal?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we'll continue to focus on, and I believe Mr. Moore mentioned this previously, is that one of the things that's really important to regulators is the desire to improve it, the process over time. So thinking about particularly compassion programs, opportunities for people to get access to product to who are dealing with serious illnesses, right, to make sure that that product is available in places like San Francisco, I think will require a refinement of regulations to make sure that that continued access is maintained.
And in San Francisco, we have dispensaries. Do we have any testing labs or growers or cultivators?
That's right. So for the entire supply chain, right, for thinking about cannabis products, we have cultivation, we have distribution, we have manufacturing, non-storefront retail, and one testing laboratory.
All in San Francisco.
That's correct.
So it's a one-stop shop, this city.
That's right.
That's great. We're here on KALW. This is City Visions 91.7 and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Alfonso Blunt Jr. and Brittany Moore, principals of Blunt & Moore. We also have Eugene Hilsman, the acting director of San Francisco's Office of Cannabis, and in studio, Lindsay Robinson, the executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. We invite you to call in with your questions or your comments. Do you work in the industry? Do you feel like the industry is overtaxed or overregulated? The number to call to join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. We have a caller on the line, line 2. Yvette?
Yes.
Yeah. What's your comment or question?
I have a comment to make. If the audience could possibly refrain from using the terminology of black market, in particular due to the historical context of how race has been used and disparate treatment of African Americans. So the continued use of the phrase black market really does put emphasis on that. So that would be my request to the audience. To change the use of black market to the illicit market, unregulated market, so we can move forward and start changing the terminology.
I think that's a great point, and we will do that for the rest of our conversation. Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. So going back to what you all are selling, tell me, what's a popular product in your dispensary, Brittany?
Right now, vape cartridges. Everyone wants to vape. And so it's funny because in the medicinal market, it was more flower and concentrates. And now vape pens and edibles have taken a huge leap in sales. And I think it's because people in the medicinal market look at it like medicine. And so people knowing that they partake is not a big deal. Whereas the recreational users kind of want to keep it hush-hush. They want to be able to go vape on their lunch break and, you know, no one smells it on them when they get back to their desk, you know, that kind of thing. And so cartridges and edibles have definitely taken a spike.
And do you find that the supply of those manufactured goods is easy to get, or is it difficult in this environment?
It's easier for those items now. I think concentrates took a hit just because of the regulations with testing. But as far as edibles and vape cartridges go, there are a lot of local vendors who have been doing this forever. And so a lot of them were able to push through, obviously not all of them, but a lot of them were able to push through and bear the cost of being in a regulated market.
And is this edibles and vape pens, or is that kind of your growth area, do you feel like?
I think so. I think flower is going to take it forever, but I think those are definitely competitors now.
And how are you, Tucky, how are you marketing your business to differentiate yourself?
A lot of guerrilla marketing, definitely a lot of just, you know, getting into the community. I'm from Oakland, born and raised, so it's just getting into different shops and outlets out there to promote where we are, who we are, what we're doing. And it's just a lot of, I'm not going to say expensive marketing, but we're doing a lot of just pull up, we're here, come check us out, you know what I mean? Bring your friends, bring your family, come down, and it's been so far so good. I mean, you know, I can't complain. I would like more, but I can't complain.
Well, Lindsay, across the industry, you had said that maybe two-thirds of municipalities don't have local ordinances allowing dispensaries. Where are there sort of dispensary deserts in the state?
Yeah, really allowing any commercial cannabis activity, so cultivation or even distribution. So we're seeing quite a bit in kind of the Central Valley, and there's pockets kind of really all over the state that I think some municipalities were really kind of sitting and waiting to see how everything rolled out in 2018 and how much tax revenue was generated and kind of hoping that the kinks would be worked out in the regulatory structure. And so we are seeing some more come online, but we definitely need more support from the state to really encourage these municipalities to embrace commercial cannabis, because it's happening in their communities anyway. So regulating it is really the best pathway forward. It allows people the opportunity to operate on the compliance side and really actually build businesses. So we're hugely supportive of cities coming on and certainly choosing ordinances that make sense for them, but that are realistic about what consumers in California need. I mean, we are the largest, you know, cannabis market in the world.
Well, what's the incentive for a municipality to go into this market when tax revenue is not what people projected it to be? It's a lot of effort for not a lot of revenue.
Sure. It is growing, you know, but it's more revenue than not, right? So if you're not taxing any cannabis activity in your community, it is still being cultivated and manufactured and sold and consumed in your town. So, you know, definitely being a part of the compliant market, it also helps strengthen the entire market, the compliant market across the state. And that's really, that's a hugely important, because so many of these folks, including the folks in the studio today, have sacrificed so much to be on the compliant side, and to have, you know, the illicit market be undercut, their ability to pay taxes and licensing fees and be in compliance and deal with OSHA and HR requirements and all the other things that it takes for a business to run. We really need One of the push points really is that we don't have those communities coming online, and we need to be able to expand that.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Hilsman, what is San Francisco doing to make sure that there's compliance and helping legal dispensaries and cultivators and manufacturers compete with the unregulated market?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the city did very early in the process of legalization was create a pathway for those operators who are already kind of in the market, in the unregulated market, to come forward, essentially declare that they were operating. And the city created a pathway for those businesses to stay in operation, right? I think it was a commitment to make sure that they were able to, you know, to come forward to say, hey, that we want to participate in the regulated market. We're willing to comply with the existing regulations, even though they might be onerous in some cases, changing and new. And that ability to kind of come forward and participate in the regulated market, I think, was a significant part of why we have so many operators who are currently in the city and stayed in the city.
But that said, I think the statistics are that 80% of sales in the industry are made on the illicit market.
Well, yeah. So in thinking about what that looks like in San Francisco, right, where we've kind of invested heavily in making sure that our operators had a pathway, both in thinking about people who've been negatively and disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs, plus the existing dispensaries, and the fact that there exists an entire robust supply chain to provide product for those dispensaries.
Well, Tucky and Bree, would you like to see more enforcement of compliance?
I think in a lot of areas, yes. Some areas, not so much.
Right, but
in areas, yes. If we have to play fair, everyone should have to play fair is kind of, you know, my thing. And I think, you know, if I may just mention in the tax situation, I think that the heavy taxes was pushing everyone to the illicit market. People would spend their money in dispensaries, and sometimes we consider the operators more than the actual consumer, and the consumer is what drives all of this. And so if the consumer can't afford the product in your store, they're going to go to the black market. They were purchasing it. There was no problem. And then we increased the tax by, you know, 30%. I mean, it's just at a point where it's unfair. And I think that if some of these agencies that are creating this legislation, if they would kind of dial down some of the tax revenue that they're trying to get off of each dollar that's spent, and they may have more dollars spent, if that makes sense. And then they may see some of the revenue that they were hoping to see. I think that they are actually just taxing it too high, and they're pushing everyone away from coming into the stores.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. I have so many thoughts on taxes, more than I ever thought I would. we're highly supportive of kind of a multi-pronged approach to dealing with the issues that folks are facing from over-regulation, I like to say. Certainly high taxes. We need to have enforcement, but it has to be done in a smart way. It cannot continue to penalize folks who have been, hit really hard, as Eugene was saying, by the war on drugs, especially in black and brown communities. We need to be mindful that there are a lot of folks who want to be compliant, again, and who can't be because of the local ordinance issue. So it has to be a multi-pronged approach. We've tried to enforce our way out of cannabis prohibition for, 70 years, and that has been a complete failure and has destroyed communities. And so we have to be thoughtful about regulating smart, taxing in a way that isn't prohibitive of people actually participating on the legal side. And we're supportive of strong efforts in Sacramento to help curtail a lot of these things, including Assembly Bill 286 by Rob Bonta, which would lower taxes. Yes, he's a representative from Alameda County, and he has a current tax bill. We had one last year that did not pass, and so this is a similar bill that would look at reducing not only the excise tax, but also suspending the cultivation tax for 3 years.
And what's the cultivation tax?
So cultivation tax is at 9%, and so that would be, that's kind of coupled with the and then the excise tax would be 15.
So
it would be reducing the excise tax from 15 to 11.
And these are probably things that consumers don't realize, the tax on the tax, which is why the cost of cannabis inside a legal dispensary is so high.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it absolutely. It really, every time it moves through the supply chain, it changes hands, it gets taxed.
And then the retail store is responsible for paying. That tax is rolled into the price every time it moves. And so the retail store now has to pay for the product, but also every tax that each person along the way has paid. And then we also have to now pass through taxes to the consumer after we've paid for these three. There are two pass-throughs as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot. And then not to mention 280E, but we'd go all night on that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about paying taxes, but first, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at KLW.org. My guests tonight are Alfonso Blunt Jr. and Brittany Moore of Blunts & Moore, a dispensary in Oakland, Eugene Hilsman, the acting director of the San Francisco's Office of Cannabis, and also Lindsay Robinson, the executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. Give us a call with your questions about the industry, whether you think it's overtaxed or overregulated. What are you buying when you go to a dispensary? The number to call to join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. You can email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on KALW.org or our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionsKALW. Before the break, one thing you guys were talking about was paying taxes, and an unusual aspect of your industry is the fact that it's hard to use banks. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do your banking, Tucky and Bree?
We don't.
I wish I could.
<It's
not existent. laughs> I wish I could. We find ways around everything. And luckily, you know, the people that we have to pay our taxes to understand what we're up against, and they've created ways for us to pay some of these things in cash. But in day-to-day business dealings, it gets challenging. It definitely does. And so you find yourself kind of using your personal accounts a little more than you should, and, you know, figuring out a way to maneuver things. And it's a challenge. And luckily, there are a couple of, you know, credit unions who are a little more lenient around your accounting and what you may be selling.
But
yeah. Well, and Lindsay, to clarify for our listeners, what is the problem with banking and being in the business of cannabis?
Yes, I actually just want to make one clarification on my on my cultivation tax numbers. I said it was 9%. It's actually $9 per ounce and $2.75 for leaves. So nine and a quarter for flower, yeah. Not 9%. Mm-hmm. I'll take that back.
Okay.
Yes, banking. You know, there are some brave credit unions that are working with the cannabis space, and we love them, mm-hmm. and we're really grateful. But yeah, it's a really difficult. It's difficult to get a bank account. It's difficult to keep a bank account. You know, everyone I know in the industry has gone through multiple bank accounts. Mm-hmm.
And the issue, just to be clear, is because the federal government considers marijuana Schedule One.
Yes, and so it's difficult for there's a big fear around banks being federally insured and dealing with cannabis money. So that is creating, again, just another issue for legal operators to work in the space. It's, you know, this is something that the voters have decided on. We have a regulatory system. We have a framework. We have laws and rules. And it seems absurd that we still do not have banking opportunities. There is a stronger push at the federal level to change that, and CCIA is working with a number of groups there, but it's still a very challenging landscape on the banking front.
Eugene, is San Francisco doing anything that is helping its businesses with the banking problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a fair amount of flexibility in how the city will receive payment for taxes, right? So the city accepts cash, check, personal business, money order, cashier's check. So in thinking about really being open to the way that people provide payment, the city has provided a fair amount of flexibility.
Got it. We have a call from Mohammed. Mohammed, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I guess my question or comment is regarding public health. You know, I'm somebody who believes in, you know, like a Medicare for all kind of system where anybody can go into hospital at any time. And when I hear about marijuana being legalized, I guess that's fine. But, I mean, you're going to pay a tax now or you're going to pay it later. I mean, just like there's taxes on soda, alcohol, tobacco. I mean, it is a carcinogenic, you know, product. And if you're a person with a significant mental health problem, I don't think marijuana is something you should be taking. I mean, as I've witnessed, I mean, the homeless people that I see smoking pot don't seem to be benefiting from it. And I know there's a lot of research out there. So my question is, I guess, really just about eventually it's going to be a public cost. eventually somebody has to pay, because it's not like a health neutral product. I mean, we don't want to kid ourselves. I mean, it is, it has effects, and that it has some of them are negative. And I'll go ahead and just listen to your answers off the air. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your question, Mohammed. Tucky Bree, what do you say to that? That marijuana is a public health issue, and the taxes that are being assessed make sense because down the line, maybe we will be dealing with a big public health problem.
My response may come off being biased, obviously. I feel like it needs to be taxed, of course, as everything does, but the high rate at which it's taxed and the amount of times that it's taxed is the issue. Nothing else is taxed as greatly as cannabis. I think that there are a lot of medicinal uses, obviously, for cannabis. And I feel as if there are other markets that may be a little more dangerous to public health than cannabis are, but they're socially accepted. I don't want to diss anyone, but alcohol, you know, it's socially accepted, but it's actually doing more damage. I don't know what illness cannabis creates, but I could be naive. I'm not sure of anything that cannabis can do to harm you, in my experience.
Eugene, what do you say to that, that marijuana is a public health issue, therefore it deserves to be taxed at a higher rate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a situation, right, in which particularly in San Francisco, the voters expressed desire to have this product be regulated, and a part of that did include taxation. I think San Francisco tried to take a reasonable approach to doing taxes, and thinking about, I mentioned before, the gross receipt tax, which would start in January 1st, 2021, which really allowed the industry to mature, right? And so currently there is no local specific cannabis tax in effect, but I do think that that was part of the bargain with voters.
And Lindsay, do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, I mean, it has definitely, I think folks have put a lot of thought into how to regulate that. That makes sense. And right now we're seeing a little too much of it, but we want to find a balance, right? We want to make sure that this is a regulated industry for sure. I think we, our testing standards are the highest in the country. We have some of the cleanest cannabis ever. So if people are going to use it, we want them to do it in safe environments. We want to make sure it's out of the hands of children. You know, some of the tax money that is being generated is going for addictive, for help after people have developed addiction, which may or may not include cannabis. So drug rehabilitation in general, there's cannabis taxes going to that. I think it's an important item for us really to discuss, because public health is a pretty broad thing, and there are a lot of things I think that cause a greater risk. I don't think anyone is saying that cannabis should just be sold in Safeway and be completely unregulated. I think we're saying the opposite. Mm-hmm. We want it tested, we want it regulated, but if we don't have a sensible system, then the unregulated side continues to grow and thrive, and that is way more of a public health issue than a regulated cannabis dispensary like Blunts and More.
Yeah. Tucky, do you have anything to add to that?
It's pretty, for me, it's kind of like a, how can I put it? Like Bree said, we don't mind the tax. It's just too much multiple times, because we have to then give that price to the customer. And, people used to spend a certain amount of money, and they're like, whoa, it done went to X amount of dollars because of taxes. And we can't tell them otherwise. You know what I mean? We're all for the regulation. It's all legal. We understand it. But it's just too much. It's hard to make the money that they're trying to make tax-wise. You're not going to see it unless you lower the money. Lower the taxes so we can get more people in, because more people are going to buy it with the taxes lower. Mm-hmm. As far as the public health thing, again, this might be just bias, but I haven't seen nobody cause any multi-car pileups or anything that I could think of off of cannabis. So I think it has more healing properties than anything. So teach is on with their opinion on that. But I don't think it's going to be a public health like nightmare unless we continue to have the illicit market and we just basically defunct everything we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked a little bit about testing. What is testing kind of, to use a poor, horrible pun, weed out, mm-hmm. From legal versus illegal cannabis?
For me, I definitely see a difference as far as just the taste, the strength, and just what it does to me on personal level. So I love that stuff is being tested and regulated and monitored. I have no problem with that whatsoever. So I definitely do see a difference from the black market side to this side as far as what the testing does for me on the whole. So it's fine for me.
pesticides, certain chemicals that are used to make things grow a little bigger. Testing kind of makes sure that you're not smoking anything that you shouldn't be smoking. You're getting the cannabis, and that if chemicals were used, they were flushed out completely and properly. But it's very important to have testing, definitely. You can definitely tell a difference, as Alfonso said, in clean cannabis.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another call. We have John on the line. Hi, John. What's your question?
I've been a marijuana smoker since I was 17, and I'm 60. And these days when I go to clubs to buy marijuana, it's extremely difficult because of all the regulations. For one, there's always security guards, and you have to take out your wallet on the street and show your ID. And then there are sometimes up to like two other computer screens that you got to get by showing your ID and being checked. And then some clubs make you hold like a wire basket. This is the Harvest Club. And then after I purchased edibles, they told me it was state law. I had to put my purchase into my backpack. And I find it very uncomfortable to buy under those conditions. And to be able to look at the products and carefully choose which would be the best ones.
Well, I'd love to get your opinions on John's retail experience, but before, let me quickly say this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the business of cannabis with Alfonso Blunt Jr. and Brittany Moore, principals of Blunts and Moore, Eugene Hilsman, the acting director of San Francisco's Office of Cannabis, and Lindsay Robinson, the executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. Please call in with your questions to join the conversation. 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK, or email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. Before we took that break, we were talking to John from San Francisco about his retail experience. What do you guys think about kind of the security and the regulation that comes around purchasing pot from a legal dispensary?
I could definitely understand how it could be frustrating, especially with John making purchases for quite some time. He's used to being able to kind of be in and out. And so there are a couple of things. Our process over at Blunts and Moore is very quick. We do have to go through security, but that is more so for the customers to be safe. Sometimes when you're in a dispensary, people assume that obviously you're working with large amounts of cash. And so just to keep everyone that comes in the door safe, we like to have security. And sometimes it does make people uncomfortable, and that's unfortunate. But I would rather you feel like you were safe. And if anything happened, there's someone to take care of the situation, because we don't want you to get caught up in something that could happen because people think we've got loads of money. As far as the check-ins and everything, I do think it's interesting. Because we have limits on how much we can sell each person a day, we have to have them check into the system so that we can keep track of how much we've already sold them. Obviously, in certain markets, people aren't used to that. I can go in a liquor store 5 million times and buy all the alcohol that I want to with no limit at all. And so when you come into a different industry, people don't understand necessarily why they have to go through these things. Our process, however, is a quick swipe of the ID and you're in the store, just so you know if you're ever over on that. On the East Bay.
Right, right. Please come in. It's a whole lot easier.
For your clients, Lindsay, at CCIA, is the added security and the added regulation making it more difficult to make a sale?
Yeah, I think it probably is in certain aspects. But, you know, this part of the, as Bree was just talking about, part of those measures are regulated. They're required. So it's not really an option to not have a security guard and to have IDs checked. But it really does depend on the location in terms of some of that. You know, they're retail operators are vulnerable. You know, we have had members robbed. We've had members robbed paying their taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, it because it is a high cash, it's a cash intensive business. There is more public safety risk there. So I can understand the measures that are taken to make sure that people are safe. But yeah, there's probably a happy balance in there somewhere.
Where do you find people are getting their supply? I'm just out of You said that in the Central Valley, which I think of as farmland, there's really not that much commercialization of cannabis. So where is it being grown, and where are people getting it? Lindsay.
Yeah, so it's being grown all over the place, which is awesome, I think. You know, there's regulated cannabis up in, you know, Northern California and Humboldt and traditional growing communities up there. There's quite a bit down in Monterey and Salinas. There's growing in San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose. It really depends on the type of cultivation, too, right? So outdoor is primarily in you know, the northern area, but then a lot of greenhouses and stuff down in kind of the coastal regions, and then warehouses still, for sure, in because there's a lot of cities that don't allow outdoor cultivation. So it really depends. But, it, you know, it's the start of the supply chain, so it's great to see that it's actually spreading out more. I think that it gives people the opportunity to participate in all different aspects of the industry.
Is it easier to get a cultivation permit than it is might be to get a retail permit?
It really depends also on the local ordinance and how difficult it is to get the permitting locally. Right now, we are actually seeing a significant backlog of licenses being processed through the Department of Food and Ag, which controls the cultivation side of the industry. And so right now, it's actually pretty difficult to get a cultivation license for a lot of folks. Even if they have a temporary license, it's a complicated landscape there, too.
Given that it's so difficult to cultivate marijuana, are we going to see the supply chain sort of contract? And is marijuana going to become harder to be supplied? Or
that's interesting. There have been some thoughts that might happen. There's also been some thoughts that we're going to see overproduction, like they've seen in Oregon, where the market was really flooded because everyone started growing cannabis, whether legally or not. And, you know, we've had a thriving underground market in California for 60-plus years. You know, we produce the best cannabis, I would say, in the world. And so, you know, we've been known for that historically. And I don't actually know whether or not there's going to be a constriction. I think it's potential that it could be more difficult to get legal cannabis. That legal, you know, kind of through the supply chain is going to be harder for legal growers, because if we lose these folks who are trying to be licensed, with the difficulty with the agencies right now, with the regulators, that could pose some real challenges to the overall compliant market.
Well, is legally cultivated cannabis more environmentally friendly than non-regulated cannabis?
I would say so. I mean, they have to. There are very strict standards for testing. You know, they have to work with it, depending on what kind of cultivation they're doing, but they have to work with a number of different agencies in order to get those local and state permits. So yes, I would say it probably is more environmentally friendly. I mean, one of the things that we've seen that has been, you know, a huge issue on the environmental side is trespass grows in state and national forests, which have been primarily happening up in the northern part of the state. Huge, massive grows, completely unregulated, using massive amounts of pesticides, leaving whole areas and watersheds contaminated, leaving tons of trash and debris behind. And they, you know, those people don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, and who knows where they're selling that cannabis.
Yeah, and didn't Governor Newsom say that he was going to be cracking down on that?
Yes, he did. I mean, I think that is certainly part of the enforcement puzzle. I think we have to be mindful that there are still communities up there of small kind of mom and pop growers who definitely want to be regulated and want to be in the supply chain versus these kind of large trespass grows, as most people call them, that there's a huge difference. And I think most people on the regulated side would like those trespass grows to probably not exist for many reasons. You know, certainly from the environmental perspective, it could be devastating to a watershed to have those grows there.
And Eugene, you mentioned that there are some cultivators in the city of San Francisco. What kind of cultivation businesses are those?
Yeah, so there it's exclusively indoor cultivation.
Mm-hmm. And how does the city regulate that?
Yeah, so one of the things that in thinking about a permanent permit for cultivation, right, there are a number of regulations that are required in thinking about things like energy requirements and water plans, waste management plans. So there are a number of things that cultivators and all activity types have to adhere to in order to receive a permit from the Office of Cannabis.
That's good to know. As we've been talking about this past hour, the business of cannabis is pretty expensive. The capital costs to get into the industry and the regulatory costs. Do you all think that in the future this is an industry that's going to become more corporate, where corporate entities have the money and the muscle to get into the market, and maybe the smaller businesses, the mom and pop businesses that we've seen prior to legalization, will be pushed out of business? What do you think, Bree?
I would say yes, that's where I think it's headed. unfortunately, they're already positioning to come in and kind of swoop us up once it goes federal, which is why I'm one of the few people on this planet who does not want it to be federally legal.
Ah.
I feel like let the states handle it, just because once it is, you know, Walmart can jump into the game. And they have resources and finances that obviously the people who have gone through the process of making this a legal market don't have. And so for us to kind of have to worry about prosecution throughout this whole journey and create a different conversation around cannabis criminalization and be the ones that are the reason why it's now a legitimate industry, and then to be swallowed up by people that kind of waited on the sides for us to do all the dirty work seems a bit unfair. And so for a lot of people right now in the industry, they're just positioning to be purchased instead of positioning to live out their dreams. And so it is probably coming to be in a hearing discussing new regulation, and to have, you know, representatives from Philip Morris sitting in the back. You know, it's very clear what their intentions are for the industry. And so I think that, you know, once it becomes corporate, they will water down the product and the industry, and it will definitely change.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful. I'm oddly optimistic through all of this, which is probably how right. I've been able to do this for so long. But I would love there to be the ability of all different types of businesses to survive in cannabis. I think the kind of small boutique craft cannabis does have a chance to thrive, but it's going to take some traditional investment oftentimes for that to happen. And that's really difficult right now because of the restrictions with banking. So, you know, it's an interesting concept. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of growth in the craft beer industry, you know, compared to like Budweiser and Coors and other, you know, beverages like that are incredibly large. I think there is always going to be a niche for the small market, for the boutique cannabis, for like the sun-grown, the beautiful kind of, you know, traditional California cannabis. But I'm hopeful that we'll see a lot of different businesses survive here. But yeah, I think some consolidation is absolutely going to happen because it is so challenging to you know, maintain and upkeep a compliant business.
Eugene, is San Francisco doing anything in particular to keep cannabis from going corporate?
Yeah, so there are some regulations governing the sale of cannabis businesses and requirements for disclosure of change in ownership that limit, for example, the ability of entities to sell a significant portion of majority interest in their entity before 10 years. So I do think the Board of Supervisors has thought a lot about this issue and making sure that businesses that have grown and developed in the city and county of San Francisco really kind of retain that kind of flavor that's unique to the area. And so it was something that was actually written into our ordinance.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but Very nice. There's, like, for example, the Apothecarium. I mean, that just got huge investments from a Canadian wellness corporation. Do you see that happening, where small mom-and-pop businesses get these corporate infusions that sort of make it look like the mom and pop is the front, but the money is really coming from corporate entities? Eugene?
What? I'm sorry.
Well,
can you repeat the question?
Yeah, well, the Apothecarium is a dispensary in San Francisco that recently got an infusion of cash from a Canadian wellness corporation. And I guess my question is, will there be mom and pop fronts, but in the background it will be larger corporate entities that have put in the cash? And does San Francisco intend to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll see a number of different models, right? So in thinking about the opportunity to take an investment, the limitation on wholesale transfer of entities is still true, right? So the opportunity to take on additional investment while making sure that a majority interest still remains.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk briefly about the effect of decriminalization and the impact on various communities. The San Francisco DA's office announced that it would be expunging over 9,300 marijuana-related convictions, and those seem disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities. Do you see people who have been affected by that criminalization coming into your industry as employees or owners, Bree and Tucky?
We have a couple of them on staff right now as employees. I, as an owner, am one. I got all my convictions and stuff sealed and expunged about 4 or 5 years ago or so. So, yes, we want the part of the whole point for me for the equity program, Bree too, is just to embrace people that had to deal with that. If we can hire, if all the staff could be that way, great. But, you know, we have a few. We embrace it. We embrace equity-owned products in the store. So, yeah, it's just, it's about giving back. The whole point of the program was for people like us to own, not to share with big corporate and then they're funding the money and we just there. No, we're owners, and that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. So.
And Bree, what are your thoughts about that?
I agree. I definitely agree. We do have all walks of life that work for us, and I'm glad that we're in a position now to give them opportunities that they otherwise would have been passed over for. And they're deserving individuals. It's not like we're just picking people because they've been through these things. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, well, you're great, and you've been through this even better. And so it's pretty awesome to be a part of what we're doing and to be giving some of the young kids that we have a chance at doing something a little different than what they were restricted to doing because of their records, regarding cannabis.
And are you seeing that industry-wide, Lindsay, that people who were affected by criminalization are coming into the market as owners or employees? Or?
Yes, but definitely not enough. When I worked for the Marijuana Policy Project, we often said that the worst and most dangerous thing about cannabis is prohibition. So once you're scarred with a record for selling or distributing cannabis, or even sometimes just having cannabis, it is really difficult to participate in a lot of traditional types of business. It's hard to become an owner. It's hard to get loans. It's hard to get jobs or federal funding for school. And so for me, that has been one of my huge motivations for working in this industry for the past 15 plus years, but it's slow going. I mean, the equity programs, and there's not that many of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them are really struggling. Oakland and San Francisco, I think, have done a good job. There's certainly kinks to be worked out. I think, we need to talk about statewide equity programs as well. We need to, really define what the equity program means and really highlight who it's helping and how it's building and growing. I think highlighting success stories is really important, mm-hmm. for sure. But, yeah, there's always opportunities for more businesses to be owned by people who've been directly affected by the war on drugs. Also more business, female-owned businesses. I think there's opportunity, obviously, we're building it from the ground up in many ways, which is part of my undying optimism, is that we have great opportunities. And so I'm glad that we are embracing some of them, but really we need to continue to have the conversation all the time about how we can grow and advance.
Real quick, for me, and I say it all the time, equity to succeed like we know it's going to succeed just needs education and more funding. That's pretty much it. Pretty much cut and dry. Just teach the people how to do what they need to do so they don't get out here and sign their life away. So
yeah. Well, if you want to get into the industry in our last minute or two, what's your advice, Tucky and Bree?
Work really hard.
I say work hard. Don't give up. Yeah, because, man, you're sitting with two stories of never giving up, even though I kind of like gave up on the whole store thing, but just – never give up. It's finally, after all these millions of years, finally seemed like it's coming around. So
I think in all seriousness, what I would say is take whatever you have going on now and apply it to the industry.
Right.
Definitely.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Eugene, if somebody's interested in joining the industry, what do they need to do?
Yeah, so right now the primary pathway to operating a new business, a new cannabis business in the city of San Francisco, is through the equity program. So for people who are interested, you can go to our website, which is officeofcannabis.sfgov.org, to learn more about the program.
And we will have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Alfonso Blunt Jr. and Brittany Moore, principals of Blunts & Moore, Eugene Hilsman, acting director of San Francisco's Office of Cannabis, and Lindsay Robinson, the executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton and yours truly. Join us next week for a look at the juvenile justice system. This is Grace Wan. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.